The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning. Good morning. Welcome to the emerging era in whistleblower rights and the public's right to know, co-sponsored by GAP, the Government Accountability Project, and American University's Washington College of Law, our gracious host. We've got a great day of programming for you today. I hope you could stick around for the entire day. If you are here, however, for the conference on our energy future, why we need offshore oil drilling, mountaintop mining, and more nukes, you're in the wrong room. This conference is about the future and energy, about energizing our government and workplaces with the sunlight of transparency and the cleansing winds of free speech. It's about pulling back the blanket of official secrecy that has transformed Washington, in the words of former Bush press secretary Scott McClellan, into a breeding ground for deception and a killing field for the truth. I'm Mark Cohen, honored to be Executive Director of the Government Accountability Project, the nation's leading advocate for and defender of whistleblowers and occupational free speech. For 31 years, GAP has stood side by side courageous citizens who have risked career, reputation, and family to do the right thing, speak their truth, and make positive change in the face of stifling corporate and governmental bureaucracies. GAP's clients often win, but it's in spite of, not because of, the law. Despite the clear language of legislation that we've helped craft over the years to prevent abuses, fraud, and dangers to public health and safety, activists, right-wing judges, have rewritten these laws and rendered them feckless or even traps for the unwitting. That's the bad news. This conference is really more about the good news. Not only are there new laws on the books and other laws pending that will enshrine whistleblower protection in the public's right to know, with your help, we aim this time to put an indelible stamp on these laws so they can't be thwarted by intellectually dishonest, ideologically driven judges. Thus, this conference is a kickoff to a nationwide campaign to ensure that these new laws are interpreted as they were written so that whistleblowers have the access to the courts that Congress intends and the public deserves. We invite you to join us in a sustained national campaign to this end. We'd be remiss if we didn't pause to mark the passing of Stuart Mott on June 12th at age 70. Stuart was a champion of the openness, civil liberties, and civil rights, and free speech agendas that animate this conference. It's fair to say that but for his generosity and that of his Fund for Constitutional Government, it's unlikely we'd even be here today. The same could be said of our friends convening under the banners of the peace and reproductive rights movements. Stuart's motto was, "Let us be known by our deeds." He was, and he'll be sorely missed. In his memory and in celebration of his life, we take Stuart's motto as our mission statement for this conference and going forward. Let us be known by our deeds. We've got three exciting panels and two extraordinary speakers for you today. Before I introduce our keynote speaker, a few housekeeping matters. And while I go over these, perhaps the first panel can come up to the dais. First of all, if you have cell phones or PDAs, please turn them off or put them on vibrate. And if you're very close to the front, turn them off altogether because they'll interfere with the sound. We are taping this event, videotaping this event. It will be webcast in parts and televised in parts. There will be crowd reaction shots as part of this. If you do not want to be telecast or webcast your image, see Dylan. Dylan, can you stand up? See Dylan at a break, and we'll capture your image there to make sure that it doesn't get captured in any kind of final production. You probably noticed the bathrooms are in the foyer right at the opposite end. We will be having our luncheon speaker all the way down kind of a serpentine hall to the right in the dining room area, and that will also be where our reception will take place tonight. A special word of thanks to Jennifer Dobson of the Washington College of Law and Sarah Goldman of the Government Accountability Project for their extraordinary work in organizing this conference. And finally, you are invited to join us for the reception this evening, immediately following the conference, in honor of GAP's 31st anniversary. Okay, back to the business at hand. What if 9/11 never happened? What if the U.S. government, acting on solid intelligence, disrupted the plot before it ever reached fruition, saving thousands of lives in the air, at the World Trade Center, and the Pentagon? Would we even have had the ongoing war in Afghanistan, let alone Iraq? Would we have had the national disgraces of Abu Ghraib and Gitmo, the Patriot Acts, affront to the Constitution? We'll never know. We can imagine, however, that history could have taken a very different course had FBI headquarters heeded its Minneapolis field office. But headquarters systematically dismissed and undermined requests by the field office to search the computer and personal effects of Zacharias Moussaoui. Then learning to fly a 747 jumbo jet at a Minnesota flight school, lessons purchased with $9,000 in cash. Had headquarters acted on Minneapolis's request, it might have connected Moussaoui's flight training and his peculiar fascination with unlocking aircraft doors to earlier warnings raised by a Phoenix agent about a suspicious flight school student in its jurisdiction. We'll never know. But we do know that Colleen Rowley, then the chief legal advisor to the Minneapolis field office, in just 2 years from retirement, put her future at risk to blow the whistle on what she described as FBI headquarters, quote, deliberately obstructing measures that could have helped disrupt September 11th attacks. Along with two other women, Time magazine named Colleen Rowley its Person of the Year in 2002 for her courageous whistleblowing. She retired from the FBI at the end of 2004 and has since remained a powerful advocate for restoring ethical decision-making and civil liberties in the conduct of the ill-conceived, ill-named, and ill-executed war on terrorism. I present to you our keynote speaker, Colleen Rowley.
Thank you. I know there are a few other whistleblowers in this audience, and I know that we've all come to understand that once you've embarked on this course of telling the truth, there's no going back. So it's not just a one-time thing, and even if you get your picture on a cover of a magazine once, it's an ongoing thing, and it doesn't actually get easier, because these corrections are still somewhere in the future. We're still on the wrong path. But I continue to do a lot of speaking out. I almost never speak to an audience like this that's so concerned with good government. This is a very rare thing, and it's very difficult because most of the people in the room know a lot more about this topic than I do. I'm just an individual who's caught up. When it comes to what makes government work and function better, many of you have written papers and scholarly academic things on this and know a lot more than I do. I did get the chance. Usually I speak to the uninformed, which is most of the country. And so I get to explain the criminal justice system and why some of these fixes, what were sold to the country as answers to fighting terrorism, are actually counterproductive. And I get a lot of jaws in the country dropping, but it's simply because they were not exposed to this information before. This is a much bigger challenge to talk to you folks. This spring, I was called in as a last-minute speaker. I knew there was something funny about it. I was called in March to be the commencement speaker at the University of Iowa's law school. And I said yes. I've done a couple of other commencements, and I said yes right away. But a couple weeks later, I found out the Iowa City papers had an article that Alberto Gonzalez was canceled for some reason, and that they had gotten this last minute, stand-in, Colleen Raleigh. And so I had my first wonderful first line to this audience of parents, and it turns out an Eighth Circuit judge was in the audience, which was it was old Mark Twain quote. I assume that Alberto Gonzalez is too busy studying, different things right now to make this appearance. He ought to remember the old Mark Twain quote, never lie, and then you don't have to remember anything. So in any event, part of the reason I was on the cover of Time magazine, so then I get invited to speak, and many times I am not introduced correctly. They almost always get the facts wrong, and then I'm in the uncomfortable situation of my very first comments have to be, no, I didn't do this. Musawi wasn't the 20th hijacker. They almost always botch it. If they would just read my own resume, but they always feel compelled to go beyond my resumes in some ways and add to it or whatever, and then they almost always get it wrong. So part of my mission, I guess, is to encourage more whistleblowing, because we are in a situation right now where many mistakes are occurring. True fraud, waste, and abuse are occurring on a daily level, and yet it's being overlooked and swept under the rug, again, constantly. And if we have more people speaking out, I think it would be hard to ignore. Not only in addition to more people speaking out, but we need more citizens in this country then to take up that cause, and as Time magazine did in my case, I was one of the very few lucky people. Well, I've come across, again, this is in talking to the less informed people. I've come across a little visual that I use, and it's a triangle, and I try to explain to people who are not conversant with the criminal justice system how at the bottom, when you have no level of evidence, you have nothing. What can an FBI agent do? What can law enforcement do? Well, in the past they could profile. That actually now Department of Justice has ended that policy of profiling for drugs and other crimes, but it still exists in the so-called war on terror. Profiling is still allowed in the war on terror. So with no level of evidence, you can still profile. You can do old FBI agency got into trouble for. You can start to collect massive data. And I don't have the list with me. I've collected now 15 of these very euphemistic titles. They all imply that you can get one of them is novel intelligence from massive data. So they all imply that there's a magic computer or a way that by adding credit and bank and telephone tolls and all of this, these kinds of private data that we used to think were private data about people, and you put it all into a giant computer. Now, of course, monitoring of telephone calls and overseas emails as well. If you put it into a computer, somehow, magically, it will home in on the terrorists, and you'll be able to disrupt terrorism. So that's the how it's being sold. The truth is, and again, if you think about the needle in the haystack, what you're doing is actually making it more difficult because you're adding more hay. Musawi case is a great example. Why did that example of that case shoot up to George Tenet in a matter of days? George Tenet was briefed with a PowerPoint on August 23rd or thereabouts. Fundamentalist learns to fly. Now, why did that piece of information shoot up? Probably because there was no clutter. There was less clutter. And when you start into these massive data collection programs of hundreds of thousands of records, the latest one that they tried to come up with, I think it's, somebody can correct me, but I think it was called Tide or something, was the clean, you know, Tide, was expected to collect 20 records for each man, woman, and child in the United States. And, you know, even Sensenbrenner, who's a very conservative, asked some questions. His main question was, does it work? Okay, so there you go. Then you get up to reasonable suspicion. This is where the national, you know, national security letters are even not even reasonable suspicion. Then you get up to, I know there's lots of lawyers in here. The biggest one is probable cause. You can stop someone. You can arrest someone. You can at that level, if you, in the old days, probably produce a 100-page affidavit in order to monitor somebody like the mafia. Takes a year to do that usually, but you could do that under probable cause. Then you go up to, if you eventually collect more evidence, every one of these, you are homing in. You're weeding out the innocent people when you proceed up. You get to conviction. Of course, a jury now reassesses. There's an accountability moment. The jury reassesses all of this investigation. And then you get to, if you want to appeal, you have your lawyers appeal it. You go through all that evidence again. And finally, the very top of this triangle is what, I don't have the room, throw away the key. When you proceed up the criminal justice system, greater intrusive techniques corresponding to greater and higher levels of evidence, you get to the top, and it's throw away the key time. You're put in prison. And, you know, I will tell you, in this system that I and others worked in, I worked in this system for 24 years, mistakes are made, even in this system. I was part of a system where we put a guy in, a bank robber in jail in Duluth for 4 months, and he was a complete lookalike for the real bank robber, and people identified him, and there were reasons for this, but he was totally innocent. So even the system like this does produce mistakes. But it's a pretty darn good system for these reasons. What we've done now... It works better when I have my triangle, because then I just tip it upside down. And I show people, we have tipped this whole very judicious system upside down. And we start now with what would be the disgrace of Guantanamo. Picking up people. Actually, it started before Guantanamo with the post-9/11 roundup. The post-9/11 roundup was just grabbing. It turned out, you know, thousand or so people right after 9/11 with no level of evidence and basically throwing away the key. Even FBI agents could not, once they realized that there was an innocent person in jail, could not even get the person out. So that is, unfortunately, just a few of the mistakes being made in the so-called war on terror. What I think is valuable in telling people is that this is a utilitarian approach. It is not just the fact that these laws and ethics in and of themselves should be followed, because you'll always lose an argument if you say, well, it's unethical. I taught ethics in the FBI since 1993 when we were forced to do the OGE, and it doesn't work to tell people it's unethical or even illegal. To be honest, right now I would say even that has less force. So what, it's illegal? I want my security. You know what? You can have your lofty ethics. I want to be protected. I have heard this argument over and over with people. If you think of it as a trade-off, you lose the argument. The truth is that these things are in sync with each other. You can be, if you follow the law, you actually are doing things that help the process of identifying the true terrorists. And the reason is it's discriminate. People ask me about my thing. You know, it's the think it's patriotic. The think part of it is discernment. And this whole judicious process is nothing but discernment and accountability. Recently, we saw where the FBI was one of the only intelligence agencies to stand up, of course, secretly stand up behind closed doors, and say, you know what, the FBI ought not to be involved in these harsh interrogation techniques. And I got the chance to speak to an intelligence and ethics group in February and come up with the reason I thought that existed. Why was the FBI? Are they more ethical than the CIA? Why was the FBI? You know, the reason I came up with is actually goes back to the law thing. The reason is, in the FBI, we were always thinking of that accountability moment when we would have to go into court and raise our right hand. Agents got grilled constantly about their in interviews and interrogations, and even the fine points of Miranda. So knowing that that accountability moment was in the future probably is the reason that the FBI agents were more sensitive to these to what was going on. I don't know, maybe somebody disagrees with me. I'm going to go back to the original. How much time do I have here? About 5 more minutes, 2 minutes? I'm going to go back to that original provocative introduction. What if 9/11 had been prevented? And there's a whole group of people, and maybe some in this room, I'm not sure, who actually posit that 9/11 was a conspiracy, you know, in order to get this fear environment going whereby people could actually have their agenda or do what they wanted to do. I actually have thought a lot about this, and I know certainly that, you know, my memo was about 9/11 could have been prevented. In fact, 9/11 was prevented. The Flight 93 itself, just because they had some warning. They had, you know, in terms of whistleblower, that plane had a few minutes of warning of what was going on. And with that few minutes of warning, they were able to prevent what would have been a much greater impact of 9/11. We all forget that actually, in fact, 9/11 was partially prevented. My memo said that, you know, 9/11 could have at least been reduced in scope. And there's a lot of ways that this could have happened. The most likely way is actually that the cockpit doors could have been bolted, and which was happened all over. And when these dots were so close to being connected, it's not too much to imagine, a failure of imagination, that someone said, put a bolt on the cockpit doors. This is just too dangerous an environment. But if that had happened, I honestly don't think I think we might have still seen the mistakes that happened afterwards. For starters, the anthrax case, which is still a cold case, never solved, it actually spurred more fear in the country because of the indiscriminate places it was popping up and killing people. I remember, reporters talking about buying duct tape. And it was not because of 9/11, it was because of the anthrax case. And then, of course, here in D.C., the sniper case. So I think the 1-2-3 thing, and if you're looking for a way to use fear in order to, you know, go forward with a prior agenda, you could have grabbed a lot of other things and then done the same type of environment fear factor. Orange alerts that put everybody in a kind of this mode of being very fearful. What I think we need, okay, I'm going to cease and desist here. What we need is greater stoicism. It's not so much courage to act recklessly, because many people think of courage as this, you know, oh, I'm going to jump in the wave and I'm going to run into the burning building. But we need more stoicism in this country, which is we have the ability, I don't care how bad or how wrong something is, we still have the ability to choose how to respond. And people, you know, who think, oh, I can't do anything, that 9/11 changed everything, that actually gives people a reason to say, well, 9/11 changed everything. We have to go along with it. And I think that at every one of these junctures where these things were happening, all of the various mistakes, the Roundup, the Guantanamo, the Orange Alerts, there were opportunities for whistleblowers and for the people of this country and the media of this country to listen to those people and to stop it at any one of those junctures. But we have, unfortunately, as a country at least, we're still in this mode of following way too much way more than we are in leading. So I would encourage everyone in this audience, I'm not speaking for my health, I want everyone to go out there and give out these messages so that we can get a larger number of people. Insiders, McClellan's book was we can debate whether he's a true whistleblower because he accepted some money for publication. But in terms of inside information, it's extremely powerful because you're hearing it from the horse's mouth. So we need more people to reveal this and get this. Okay. There's some bullet holes in here. I don't know how this happened. The last speaker, but you know what? Tipping that thing upside down, I used it as a bad example, but in government, it's a good example. This is democracy, and these are all the inputs going down where you do have a good decision at the end. And we need this kind of open government and deliberation and debate and true democracy as opposed to upside down where we get the orders from on high and everyone blindly follows and salutes and follows them. Thank you very much.